You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is writer Lady Hubbard, whose first novel is gaining great reviews. The Talented Ripkins draws us in with a story about a family with peculiar talents, superpowers, if you will, and a man who's rediscovering his lost ideals and sharing his family's story with a new generation, also with special talents. 72-year-old Johnny Ripkins is a thief on the run who only came back to his family because a mobster would kill him if he doesn't pay off a sizable debt by the end of the week. Johnny is a cartographer who can draw maps about anywhere, whether he's been there or not. His half-brother could scale any wall. Together, they were burglars. As we learn through the book, the rest of the Ripkin clan have unique talents as well. Flash, Captain Dynamite, and the Hammer. You get the idea. Most were united during the Civil Rights era in something called the Justice Committee, but today they've all gone their separate ways. Lady Hubbard reintroduces us to this clan in her book, The Talented Ripkins, published by Melville House. Hubbard is the winner of the 2016 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and the William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition for the short story. This is her first novel, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Lady Hubbard, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Your new book, The Talented Ripkins, tells a story of a family, an unusual family, and a man's rediscovery of his ideals, the quest for racial justice. But it all begins in a wonderful way where we meet Johnny Ripkins, who is on the run, basically. He owes money to a mobster boss, and so he's forced to move around the state to claim some money that he's had hidden to pay off this mobster boss. What an interesting way to get into this story. What was the origins of this story?
Well, I think it was the idea of being in debt. Like all the action is thereby he's under threat, but it's because he owes this debt, and the idea of a debt as a motivating factor, and it kind of forces him to deal with a lot of unfinished business in his past. But the idea of debt and paying back what you owe, in this case, in the under threat of his life, sort of is a way of situating the past in the present. That was actually what I was thinking about when I did that.
So. And very quickly, we learn that as he makes his first stop, we begin to learn a lot about Johnny Ripkins. He apparently made maps in which he had never had to be at a location to make a map. He was a cartographer, but he had this ability to make maps of places he'd never been or never seen. And this was his special superpower. And we come to understand that, in fact, his family is full of superpowers. They're not the sort of superpowers that make a Marvel comic book or a Justice League comic book. They're unusual superpowers. Where did that idea come from?
Right. So every member of the Ripkin family, his name is Johnny Ripkin, has a specific talent for superpower. So one can see in the dark. One can scale any wall, one can pick any lock, and Johnny's power is to make these maps. So part of what was influencing the book was there's an essay by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Talented Tenth. And so a lot of the things that happen in the novel, I guess I'm playing with, it's not a direct. They're not always direct references to it, but it is playing with some of the ideas and my impressions of them and also popular interpretations of those ideas that were expressed by Du Bois in The Talented Tenth and just sort of putting them in a different context. So the book literalizes the idea of talent. They all have, I guess, mild superpowers.
Mild superpowers. Yeah, that's right.
How to describe them?
Yeah, but
yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the one can belch fire. You mentioned the one that can climb walls. Mm-hmm. He meets a family member that he hadn't met before who can see in the dark. But I've never read The Talented Tenth by W.E.B. Du Bois, but I looked up a little bit about that, and it seems to me it's an essay written at the beginning of the 20th century talking about how 1 in 10 African Americans had the ability to transform African Americans in America by being teachers, by being leaders for the race. So tell us a little bit about this essay.
Well, the essay, he's saying that 1/10 of the population is sort of naturally endowed with sort of superior talent that would qualify them to become the leadership class for African Americans. It was really the essay is really a plea for providing opportunities for a liberal arts education for African Americans at the turn of the 20th century, when there was a lot of discussion about whether any provisions for higher education for Black people in the South should be given to them at all. So it's often, well, I wish more people would read it and think about what he's actually saying in it, but also it gets misinterpreted when taken out of context. It does sort of sound like the Talented Tenth. It does sort of sound like they're superheroes, like a superhero group, like a Fantastic Four or something. So that's one of the things that I'm probably playing with in the novel. But the essay itself was really written in a very specific context and for a specific audience. So it's really an impassioned plea to provide educational opportunities for, African Americans in the South.
Well, we have to remember the sort of the framing of the debate of that time. It was about whether it was worth any effort to educate African Americans at all, at least in the South, right?
That's right. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, it's often just sometimes you'll hear the term the Talented Tenth talked about as like it's an elitist term,
right?
But it is really within the context. It's a pretty impassioned plea just to have any educational opportunities for Black people be made available at that time. I think it's important to take it in context.
Right.
What I meant.
I think it's really interesting. You have an interesting imagination that would flip that into these sort of modest superpowers of this family.
Right. Well, because it's not really talent, the idea of talent, or even, I guess, in if you're literalizing it as a superpower, it's like it's not prescriptive in terms of what you're actually going to do with that talent, right? Because part of the hard part really is figuring out what you can actually accomplish, what you can do, and how to best use the talents that you have to achieve your goals. So that is, as opposed to having it being something really straightforward, this is my incredible superpower and this is how you use it and I'm obviously like amazing and a leader. No, it's more about figuring out, it's more about the characters figuring out what, if anything, they can put these talents to use for.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the book, we know that Johnny Ripkins is on the run. He's going to the home of his half-brother Franklin, which only through time do we realize that he never even realized he had a half-brother until he was already grown. And again, this gets to these secrets of this family, the Ripkins. And you've created this elaborate backstory of this family going back several generations to a man known as the Rib King, and that's how the name the Ripkins comes together. And the Rib King was, tell us about this family, of this family you constructed.
Yeah, so every character, the Rib King is sort of it's like a legendary, at least to the other members of the family, figure. He's like the patriarch, right? They all sort of trace their roots back to the Rib King, who invented what became a very popular barbecue sauce what it said in the book. That's where the name the Rib King comes from, because he appeared in the ads. There's a caricature of him that appears in the ads, and it's actually the only image of him that his descendants have. It's a caricature for an ad for barbecue sauce.
And, so, it's a very late 19th century sort of caricature of, you know, it's all the horrible stereotypes associated with that, right?
Right. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So they, you know, but that's all they have to hold on to. And every character mentions him at some point, and what they all remember about those sort of the legends and myths that surround his life is completely different. It becomes a completely different person for each one of their descendants. So their interpretation of their own history gives them strength and inspires them, and it also is sort of used as a way to fortify the choices that they've made in life. They're doing things that the Rib King would have approved of. But they all have different interpretations of who he actually was. So they're all doing different things because he would have approved of them. So
when Johnny Ripkins comes to his half-brother's home, he finds out that his half-brother, who is no longer living, had a daughter who, again, he never knew. And very quickly, he sees that she also has this special power. And he's digging up money that he's hidden in the backyard. And what we begin to learn is that even though we know that he was on the run, he's on the run from a mobster, so we were very quickly learning that he is and his half-brother have been burglars, committing spectacular burglaries, they weren't always that way. In fact, they had this very strong idealistic side. And we begin to learn about this point of idealism where a group of them joined together with other people calling themselves the Justice Committee. And it was at the height of the Civil Rights era. And I'm assuming as the Civil Rights era falls apart, this group also sort of falls apart.
Yeah, well, that's his Johnny Ripkins. That's his particular backstory. He was very devastated by when the Justice Committee fell apart. But over the course of the novel, you kind of see he's 72 when the novel starts, and he really has spent most of his life trying to use his talent for the greater good, and it's often backfired for him. And he didn't meet his brother until after the Justice Committee fell apart. He was already a bit disillusioned. So that's part of the guilt he has when he realizes he has this niece that he didn't know he had. And I think part of why he wants to set a good example for her is because he doesn't feel like he really did that for his brother because of where he was when he met his brother. He was already a grown man, he'd already had all these experiences, and he was a bit disillusioned and cynical at that point. So that's part of the debt in his mind that he's trying to make up with his niece.
Well, as we mentioned, at the first home, he meets this niece, and the mother is sort of living her own life, stuck with a daughter that she doesn't seem to, she cares for, but she doesn't really one in her life. And so she says, take my daughter. I have a job to do for a couple of weeks on a cruise ship or something like that. And says, you know, take my daughter. And so he begins telling this story of this family history that is unknown to Eloise, the niece.
Right.
And he sort of starts reconnecting with his family story also because he's going to various family members where he's hidden money to pay off this debt. And while it sounds very convoluted, in my ham-handed explanation, the book is actually just a wonderful, wonderful read as this sort of life sort of unfolds. And you do a wonderful job of first drawing us in with this story of, I've got to repay this debt, it's due in a week, or I'm a dead man, into this whole family story.
I just want to say about Eloise's mother, because I know I think she really does care. And when you get closer to the end, I think it becomes more apparent that she really does care about Eloise, that it's it has been really hard for her to be a single mother and take care of her. So it's not, and also because Eloise has a talent like the rest of the Ripkins, and it is for her mother a bit disturbing. Eloise can catch anything that's thrown at her. So she's gotten in the habit of the first time Johnny sees her talent, is there's other kids are throwing cans at her daughter while her daughter sort of stands with her eyes closed and she's catching all these cans. So her talent is actually a little bit disturbing to the mother. So part of the of her asking Johnny to take her with him for a little while is because she doesn't really know how to care for someone who has a talent like that. So for her, it's like a game, but it's really kind of painful for the mother to see people threatening violence to her daughter. That's essentially what it looks like. Even though she catches them, she always catches them. They're acting as if it's a joke to throw rocks at her and things like that, but she'll catch them. So it's a very, of all the talents that you see in the book, Eloise's is probably the most problematic. So that's a big part of why her mother wants her to go with Johnny, because she thinks the Ripkins are very peculiar, is what she says. But they teach her how to sort of get along with this peculiarity or talent or whatever you choose to call it, because she's used to it and she's not. So that's a big part of why she wants Eloise to go with him for a little while.
My guest today is Lady Hubbard. Her first novel is titled The Talented Ripkins. It's published by Melville House. It's telling the story of this family, a man's discovering his lost ideals, and it's sort of rediscovering his family along the way, this past quest for racial justice and telling the story of this unique family. I'm interested, you know, you have all these talents that this family has. How much thought went into sort of thinking, okay, I'm going to have Eloise be able to catch anything that's thrown to her. I'm going to have, a cousin that can belch fire. all these unusual sort of, not necessarily the first gifts you would think of, hey, if I could have a superpower, what would it be? It's not the first thing you would think of, but how much thought went into that as you were sort of planning this book out?
A lot of thought in the sense that I think that their talents have really, really have a huge impact on their personality. So in terms of constructing the characters and the things they say and their beliefs, that the talents are actually a manifestation of that. So sometimes I say, like, because they don't always know what to do with their talents, they've often assumed the form of sort of idiosyncratic compulsions on their part. It really had a huge effect on how they move through the world and sort of how they perceive the world. So they're very intimately connected to their character. So to the point that I can even say which came first, the people or their talents, because they're very merged in my mind.
Yeah. No, and as Johnny goes around the state, the story sort of becomes, it's in many ways, it's sort of this multi-generational road story, because mm-hmm. he's moving around the state, going from cash to come up with the money to pay off this debt, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. You know, it's almost like from another generation where you would hide money in the backyard or dig a hole
right.
and put money into it. What went into that idea as this sort of way to crisscross the state and for Eloise to get to know her uncle?
Yeah, well, I was aware of people doing that. And actually, my grandfather used to hide money a lot. So just from, you're not really, you know, trusting institutions. So that has a long history, and so that's probably in part where I got that from. But also because he is a map maker, so he, you know, would feel pretty confident. If you don't trust institutions, you could just do this, no one else will find it, and I will be able to get back to it when I need it. So it was a combination of things. It seemed to fit his personality, and again, like sort of the way he exists in the world, that he would have done something like that.
Well, it's a really interesting book. The name of the book is The Talented Ripkins. It's published by Melville House. My guest today is Lady Hubbard, young writer who this is her first novel. Now, you've been writing short stories. How long were you working on this novel?
About 4 years. It took about 4 years to write, so a long time.
During that 4 years, how much did the novel change? Did you have a real good sense of it from the beginning, or has it gone through a lot of changes through that 4 year process?
It's gone through a lot of changing. And actually, it started as a short story. The first chapter, which was very different, was a short story originally, and then I kept thinking about the characters, and I realized I wanted to expand it. He always had I think 5 encounters with the other members of the Justice Committee. So the route that he took to get there and basically everything else changed many, many times, because there's a lot to try and figure out how to organize so that it made sense and was clear and had momentum and like flow, because there's quite a bit going on in the book.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Justice Committee itself. What did the Justice Committee do during the Civil Rights era?
Yeah, they saw themselves, I will describe it the way Johnny describes it. They saw themselves as they wanted to do whatever they could to ensure the lives of people they thought of as their heroes. They wanted them to keep going. They never actually talk about themselves as heroes. They just wanted to figure out a way in specific moments, how can they use their talents to sort of assist the continued progress of the civil rights movement. They did a lot of security and stuff like that, and just trying to keep people safe. That's how he describes what they did. So they weren't the focus of this. They're sort of tangential figures in relation to the civil rights movement.
And Johnny, as a map maker, he makes maps to make travel safe in a South where, especially during the 1960s, where any newcomer was thought of as an outside agitator. I mean, that's a great way to describe it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. There's a period where he is, and these actually existed. I think beginning, they first started coming out in the 30s. They were like travel guides for black motorists that
right.
would tell them where it was safe to stop just to get gas or supplies.
Or go to the restroom along the highway,
right.
you know, a place where you could go to the restroom while you're traveling.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that is the kind of gesture I'm talking about in terms of using ways in which you could use map-making skills for the good of other people. He's just trying to, and he's very interested in facilitating movement. Like he talks about he's trying to find ways out and weave around obstacles. This is what he does with his map a lot of the time in his mind. So he's very, when he talks about the civil rights movement, he means from his perspective, literally trying to facilitate the physical movement of people, often, who might feel stuck otherwise.
Now, the book crisscrosses Florida. You're in Lehigh, you're in Sarasota, you're in Fort Myers, St. Augustine, and various places across Florida. Are these places that I know you grew up in Florida, among other places. You grew up in a number of places, but are these places you wanted to write about?
Yeah, well, that was very natural. I lived in a lot of different places, but my grandparents are from St. Petersburg, Florida, and throughout my entire childhood, I spent my summers with them. So that really is sort of home for me, is Florida in a certain sense. Yeah, I have a lot of associations. My most direct associations with my extended family and with my grandparents are very much associated with Florida. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
My guest today is Lady Hubbard. Her new book is titled The Talented Ripkins. It's her first novel. It's getting great reviews, and it's published by Melville House, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, you said part of the story of The Talented Ripkins comes from your own life as far as Florida being home and sort of having this connection to the setting for your first novel. Now you're living in New Orleans. Are you wanting to write about New Orleans? I mean, that's sort of a regular stomping ground for writers living in New Orleans. You write about it. Are you to that point where you're writing about something like New Orleans at this point?
I do. It definitely comes through in a lot of my short stories, so it's kind of inevitable. It's New Orleans is such a mythologized city that it's kind of like a little bit intimidating for me. I mean, in that sense, it's very different from writing about these cities in Florida, because there's so much written about the city that sometimes I feel like you would have to address all of that, all of the myths and legends of the city to write a novel based here, which is still a little bit intimidating for me. But I do draw a lot of inspiration from being here and the people that are here. But it comes through more in my short stories, I think.
I would think it'd be a city you really have to live in a while before you could really write about it.
Exactly, yeah, because it is, it's so complicated, and the energy of it is very intense. It is very, I mean, there's a reason why it's such a mythologized city, because it really is very unique in ways that are good and bad. So it's a very distinct place. There's a lot of creative energy here, which is probably why so many artists are drawn to it. But it is it's very complicated to try and write about coherently.
Well, you've written wonderfully about Florida and about this amazing family, The Talented Ripkins. It's published by Melville House. And I know, the book is just published and you're probably wanting to sit back for a little while, but are you already working on a new project at this point?
I am. I've been working. I really like to write. That's like, for me, that's what I most like to do. So I'm kind of always writing. But I am. I'm working on I have a collection of short stories and also another novel that I'm working on right now.
Well, congratulations on The Talented Ripkins. Lady, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Writer Lady Hubbard's first novel is titled The Talented Ripkins. It's published by Melville House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.